I've seen quotes from you, and I've even heard from you in person in the past, that you believe Linux, the kernel, supports more devices than any other operating system ever. And I think you can back that up, but can you talk more about that?
I can back it up by that's true.
Fair enough.
And it's been independently verified by somebody from Microsoft.
What makes Linux capable of doing this? Is it development process? Is it ease of writing drivers? Is this sheer stubbornness on parts of people like you? What is it?
I think it's all of that. Ease of writing drivers. Linux drivers are at normally one-third smaller than Windows drivers or other operating system drivers. We have all the examples there, so it's trivial to write a new one if you have new hardware, usually, because you can copy the code and go. We maintain them for forever. So old ones don't disappear, and we run on every single processor out there. I mean, Linux is we're 80-some percent of the world's top 500 supercomputers right now,
mm-hmm.
and we're also the number one embedded operating system today. We got both sides of the market.
Right.
It's pretty amazing. So I don't know why, but what we're doing something right.
Well, a lot of people listening to this or reading this are going to say, now, wait a second, I just bought a new computer and plugged in this peripheral and it didn't work. How can you say that you support all this great hardware when I just bought a new piece of hardware and it doesn't work?
Yeah, so the thing about drivers is the vast majority, the number doesn't matter. You only care about what you have.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes personal. So what you have is a very small number of devices. To be fair, so I originally thought that. We don't have a lot of devices that are supported. Let's work on that. So I started the Linux Driver Project saying, hey, we will write any driver for anybody and maintain it for free for you,
mm-hmm.
For companies. And I got an underwhelming amount of responses
right.
from companies. I got a huge response from developers. I have over 300 people willing to help out with this. Which
last
I thought
number I heard was 100. 300 is just amazing.
Yeah, we have 300 now. It was 100 in the first week, I think, or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. So I went and asked every single hardware manufacturer, the big guys that ship the boxes, Dell, IBM, HP, what do you ship that isn't supported by Linux? And they came back with nothing. Everything's supported by Linux. So if you have a device that isn't supported by Linux that's being shipped today, let me know. to be fair, there's two major classes of devices that we did find that have limited support. One is the video camera, webcams type thing, and those are now with the latest kernel. We've done a lot of work there, and there's a lot more device support. We support almost, I think the next kernel that's going to come out, it supports almost everything that we know about. So that those developers have gotten it together and are doing great strides. And if it doesn't work, contact them. They'll get it to work. They're doing really good on that. After that, there's wireless devices.
Mm-hmm.
And before, so about a year ago, wireless wasn't doing so well. We got a bunch of people working on that now, and everything is supported now. Athros now is open source drivers. Intel, everything is supported. Marvell is supported. The one holdout is Broadcom, but even they have Linux drivers, just closed source. So there is Linux support out there if you have hardware. So I really don't know of any major device out there that we don't support. And
of course, there's a difference between a major device and a minor device, but
there is. And so minor devices. So I go, I scour, the Fry's, or if I'm traveling in Japan, the weird odd USB devices that are funky. So what do we have support for that? And like, I had one as a button that you push and it.
You showed that one to me actually after you came back from Japan.
You're right. Yeah, I saw that one. So that works on Linux now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of weird minor devices like that we don't have the best support for. And to be fair, it's happening. Just talk to us. We'll talk with the company and get the device support and get the specs on how to work on the device, and we'll get it done.
Are you having more success talking to companies now after you started the project, or is that still slow going in some cases?
I'm having a really good success nowadays. A lot of companies are coming and talking to us, and they want us to get support for before their hardware is out. They're working with us to announce drivers at time their hardware is released. I'm working with some network card guys, they're doing really good stuff. Some video capture guys, they're working on really high speed devices that they want support when their hardware is available. So it's working out really well.
Are you seeing this more from companies in Taiwan who don't really care about keeping their scary intellectual property cards really close, or you've seen it from all over the world?
From the U.S. Yeah, so there's a company here in Portland that does video capture devices, high-speed video capture devices using USB.
Mm-hmm.
We have Linux drivers for them now. There's another company that does network cards. They have, I have a 1 gigabyte driver in my tree right now, and I have a 10 gigabyte driver for hardware that they don't even ship yet. That's in my tree. You can use it if you want. you don't have any hardware. And those are U.S.-based companies. So there's a lot of U.S.-based companies that are realizing their customers are asking for Linux support. And also there are Taiwanese companies. I'm talking with some other chip manufacturers there. VIA is a great example. I've been talking with them for a while, and now the Harold Velt's working for them. We're continuing that, and that's going very well. But so it's not just the Taiwanese guys. It's everybody, to be fair.
Did something change in the past year or so to make this to improve the situation?
I don't know. It's just the word gets around, just being persistent. I don't really know what, to be fair, I don't know.
Okay,
2 years ago, I wasn't saying that I'd do this for people, you know, so I didn't know about that.
Well, even 1 year ago, I don't think I'd ever seen you say that the situation was improving.
No, you're right. 1 year ago, it wasn't. So now I do feel like it is. It's enough to keep a couple of us working on this full time, so I feel very well. Even I'm working on VMware drivers right now, too.
Really?
Yeah, not through them. They released a lot of their code under the GPL.
Mm-hmm.
So we took their drivers, cleaned them up, and are working on getting them in the kernel tree. And doing that, I've actually talked to them and working with those developers after the fact.
Right. One of the benefits I've always seen people say of getting code into the kernel tree, or really any benefit of getting code into upstream, is that someone else will maintain it for you. And one of the reasons I've seen you say why you really, really want to do this is not just because the kernel changes so fast, but because the more drivers you have in the tree, the more you can find similarities between them, find better abstractions, better ways of doing things and sharing code between them. Is that argument compelling to device manufacturers?
To individual people, no. That's not a compelling one, because they just care about making their device and running with it, and they don't care about other companies. At first glance, I have a USB data acquisition driver in the kernel that originally some company in Germany created, and they wanted to get it in, and we realized that about four different companies' drivers all did the same thing, so we all merged it into one.
Mm-hmm.
And now none of those companies have to maintain it. They all get their support for free. Users benefit in the fact that they all have one tinier code base.
Right.
And so the original German company is very happy about it. So they're static. They don't have to worry about it anymore, and it just works for them. And actually, there's another company here in Portland that uses that same driver, and they're very happy about it too. So it makes people realize that I think over time that the Linux development model has benefits, but it's really hard to convince them until they've gone through that.
I've heard people say that there's a mentoring process you have to go through, not just trying to get their code of quality to get accepted in somebody's tree for eventual inclusion, but to understand that there is a different development model and it works. Is that an easy process or a difficult process, or does it really depend on the company?
There's different companies work in different ways. Different engineers are used to working in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
We've done a really, really big job in trying to document what our process is, how it works, how to get involved. There's a how-to document in the kernel that shows you a pointer to all bunch of different things. And Jonathan Corbett from Linux Weekly News just published, I think, a 20-page paper on detailing every step of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's documented extremely well on how to go about it. We have people, myself included, and the people that I work with that are glad to handhold companies through the process. If you have any questions about it, let me know, and I can put you in contact with the right people.
You almost make me wish I were a company here, Greg. Almost.
Almost.
Let's change direction just a little bit, talk more about the process, because you brought that up. One of the ways that most people only ever interact with the kernel is, if they're a programmer at all, they do syscalls. And most people aren't programmers, of course. They only interact with the kernel because there are lots of other pieces of software running on top of it. And that requires them to get the kernel packaged from somewhere. What do you think about people's impressions of the kernel being formed based on, I get a kernel from Red Hat, I get a kernel from Novell, I get a kernel from CentOS, and they've compiled these things in, they've compiled these things out. Is that difficult for you to see software mispackaged sometimes, or horribly behind the curve, or is that just the fact of life here?
Well, I also have another hat. I also work for Novell and package their kernel for them.
Right.
So I hope I'm doing a good job there.
Heard anybody complain about your particular.
Right. I'm one of the people. There are many of us that do that job
right.
at Novell. We have different product. People do different for different things. But I think you got two different questions there. So there's looking at packages in general, I think the distros do a very good job in taking the kernel and setting everything up properly and giving it to customers. I think that works out really well. The kernel is very configurable, but by doing that, we try and make it so that the defaults all just work properly. The most configuration we have is what drivers do you want to build in or build as a module, and distros just build them all. Because we don't know what hardware you have. And then we automatically load what you have based on your machine, what you have there at the time. So I think they're packaging it very well. But then there's the, you alluded to the, are they behind the times? And that goes, I have a big beef with the fact that the enterprise distros and a lot of the embedded companies ship very old kernels.
And not just very old kernels, but very old kernels, and they have to backport new features and drivers sometimes.
Exactly. They backport old features or new features and drivers and stuff, and it's a big, big pain. Mm-hmm. And I think that model is wrong, and I say this as somebody who gets paid doing this. So I think that model is wrong. I've said it, think it's wrong for a number of years because of the fact that a kernel, the Linux kernel, if the developers are doing their job right, you should be able to replace the kernel, and everything that was working fine for you today, you replace the kernel, it should work for you tomorrow. If not, we did our job wrong. We don't break the API for user space to kernel space. We don't do that. So people are very hesitant in change. The traditional model, and that's what they're used to with the traditional model of operating systems, is their kernel or their operating system changes every 4 to 5 years, just due to the fact that they had a very slow rate of change at a small number of engineers, and there wasn't many features going on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if you look at how companies, so users require support from usually big customers like SAP, Oracle, that certify their products on a specific kernel or product. And I'm trying to get those companies to switch away from that model. Talked to a lot of customers that have very big IT shops, and they said, we'd be glad to run the kernel of the day if only our SAP, Oracle, not to pick on those, but there's a lot of these big products, they would say that they would support that. And I'm working on that. So we're working on trying to do that. There's some fun things we can do with virtualization there and get away with some things that we're looking at doing, but it'd be really good if you could always just replace the kernel, get the latest driver, latest updates, and your program. I mean, Oracle won't break, and we're not going to change anything there.
Right. Well, I've upgraded my kernel once or twice, and Suspend stopped working, but you know, that's a different question. I wouldn't want to run Oracle on my laptop, for example.
Right. And if Suspend, we treat regressions very seriously. We'll rip out features we added if we find out that we caused a regression.
Mm-hmm.
Suspend is, I bet it's suspended, it just didn't resume, right? Resume is hard.
Well, no, actually, I've seen kernel panics on Hibernate occasionally.
Oh, okay, that's not good.
But again, I don't know whether that's one particular driver I have loaded, or I put my wireless card in power saving mode and it didn't like that, or you know, it could have been a lot of things.
Right, and we'd be glad to help work on that. Suspend and resume is a tough problem. Pardon me?
It's a very tough problem.
It's a very tough problem, and the hardest problem is we don't have access to specs for the laptop.
Exactly.
And there are some companies that do work with us and the kernel people, and Suspend Resume works wonderfully on those machines.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, like, just find a kernel developer and buy the machine that they have, because that usually works. That's a bad thing. But companies have realized that and start giving hardware away to keep people because of that, too.
Yeah, exactly. I think Jim Zemlin said, I'm running, this was before the new version of Ubuntu came out. He said, I'm running the pre-release version because I just hand my laptop to somebody and he fixes it for me.
Right.
So you want to live near a kernel developer. I get that. I've done that.
Sure.
You mentioned API support. You never break the API for user land, but I'm going to quote you again here. You say it's nonsense to have a stable ABI, and you've convinced me, but I'm not sure you've convinced everybody.
Well, okay, and I will point out that every operating system breaks their internal, this is the internal API within the kernel,
mm-hmm.
breaks their kernel API every single time. The only way it doesn't break their API is if their operating system is dead and is not being developed anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It just is on it's just a different time frame. Windows time frame of internal API changes is 4, 5 years, 6 years sometimes. Solaris, 3, 4, 5 years. AIX, 6, 7 years. But they change. Every operating system changes. It's not a new thing. It's just that Linux has developed so much faster that you see it more. I mean, ask anybody who's done Windows driver development. I used to do Windows driver development before I started working on Linux. It changes all the time. I'm on the Windows driver development mailing list, and it's the best mailing list in the world. because I hear things, and I have bunches of quotes, but lots of things are saying, hey, what happened? What changed in the service pack? And they'll detail what changed, and the people go off and fix their drivers. It changes all the time. So it is not unique to Linux by any means, and I want to make that very clear. There's marketing perception out there that for some reason people think that the API doesn't change in other operating systems, and that's just flat out not.
You think it's a convenient scapegoat for something else then?
I think it's an excuse people use who don't understand the problem. The fact that our API changes radically, very, very quickly, is not a problem once you get your driver into the kernel, because the rate of change happens and your driver will be fixed along with it.
But if you're trying to get a driver in the kernel and it may take 6 months for that process, I can see that not being pleasant every day.
Right. And I will agree with that. And so that is why we have things like the Linux Next tree to test out the API changes. We have my staging tree, which you can stage it in there for as long as you want, and we will fix up the API changes as it goes. But it also, I mean, if you're spending 6 months to write a driver, that seems a little bit suspect to me.
Well, it may not be 6 months to write the driver, but you do need to meet coding standards to get it in the kernel, and you have to get a subsystem maintainer's attention, right?
Right, and the coding standards are well documented. We have tools now that will pretty much do it for you. That's trivial. I mean, I say it's trivial. I spend a lot of my time fixing up other companies' drivers to meet our standards. So it is a lot of work.
Right.
But that's simple work to do. After that, it's, getting attention. And if you aren't getting people's attention, let me know or let Andrew Morden know, and we will get those people's attention. I think there should be no excuse there. I don't know of anybody these days, any subsystem maintainer that actually, I think there's only one or two that do not get paid for the job.
Right.
I think that's pretty rare these days. So they all should pay attention to it, and they all usually do. I don't know of anybody that falls down the job.
It sounds like the big work now is just convincing people to work within the Linux development model.
Right.
Rather than trying to shoehorn Linux into their existing development model.
Exactly. And that is part of an education process within the company itself, and they change it, and it's a process. It's an evolutionary process. I've seen lots of companies work on it. I've worked on it since at IBM, Novell, and all these other companies I'm working on a day-to-day basis with. It's a change, and it's different from their old model.
Right. And I have to say, I agree with you, especially in terms of migration pain. I mean, if I upgrade every couple of weeks, that's a much smaller upgrade, much smaller changes are possible than if I only upgraded every 2 or 3 years.
Exactly.
You have the migration and upgrade pain either way, but it's like stubbing your toe versus breaking your leg. Neither one is very fun, but my toe's not going to throb in 5 minutes, whereas it's going to take me 6 weeks to grow another leg.
Right. If you look at, and there's some distros out there that provide a constant rolling upgrade. Debian and Gentoo are two very good examples of that. You never do once you install a Debian or Gentoo box, you never do a major install again, ever, usually. You're just constantly
usually.
Slow.
Hopefully.
Usually. Hopefully. It's slow upgrades over time, and it works
right.
Very well. The Gentoo model is very nice. I like that a lot.
I know why you like that model a lot, actually. Most kernel developers run a Gentoo, don't they?
They did. I'm also a Gentoo developer. Gentoo and Debian was used a lot. A lot of the stuff we did with some of the testing for the enterprise distros was done in Debian and Gentoo because we get some good feedback and turnaround time for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we do play in both, but I also do. I do a lot with OpenSUSE. I know the Fedora developers. Those are development systems that are kept up to date very quickly.
Right.
Good ones
right.
to use.
Put a lot of resources into doing that as well.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit more about the kernel development model. It changed a couple of years ago, I think, in part because a lot of people were frustrated by this backporting scenario, the fact that it took, 3 years to get kernel 2.6 ready?
Yeah.
Now you're using a time-based release schedule, which I find really fascinating, especially looking at graphs that say, okay, here's the merge window, and here's the size of the next tree, and look at just skip down to nothing every time the merge window opens. Are you and other developers really comfortable with this time-based model?
Yeah, it's really good. We went through the 2.4 to 2.5 model to 2.6, and that was horrible. Distros were backporting stuff from the 2.5 kernel that they wanted, and they needed new hardware support. They needed new scheduler development, and it just took forever. And once we got 2.6 going, after the first year, we kind of realized, hey, this time-based model, this is kind of fun. Let's just keep doing it. So we documented what we were doing, and everybody's like, oh, you changed your model. And we're like, we've been doing this for a year. Haven't you been paying attention?
Exactly.
And we've kept going, and it's very predictable. And the distros like it because they can look at and say, hey, we know a kernel's going to come out every between 2 and 3 months, and we can plan what we want to get done when, and we can go with that and run with it. And it's very nice. It's working out really, really well. It's actually increased our rate of developers, our number of companies participating, our number of developers participating. They get better feedback. So I think it's working really, really well. There are some people who are worried about stability, but that's another question.
Yeah, that is my question. I mean, I've heard questions about stability. I've heard questions about quality. One of the things I noticed from the earlier model is that you could Linus could release a pre-release kernel and he wouldn't get much testing on it. And I think he's actually said this multiple times. If you want to get someone to test your software, you release it, and then you get them to come back to you and complain that it wasn't as stable as you said it was.
Right. So we're now doing that every 3 months, which is good. We get more people testing it out that way. And also people are very resistant to change. The traditional model is you don't change something that's not broken, right?
Right.
I mean, traditional software engineering model is very much so. That really, really flies in the face of the fact of reality is that the world changes, so we have to change in regards to that. We're not making all these changes just for fun. We're making these changes because we have to, and we're reacting to external stimuli. I mean, Linus's famous quote is Linux is not intelligent design, it's evolution. I mean, we evolved the kernel. I mean, if we had set out to design an operating system that could support, 48 different processors and all these devices, we couldn't have done it.
Right.
But by all these little tiny changes all along the way, it's turned out to be something that works really, really well. People are worried about quality, and to be fair, I see all the bugs for the kernel for two different distros and the bugzilla.kernel.org ones, and the number of bugs reported has been flat, while as our number of lines of code have gone up, and I think our number of users have gone up.
I think you're probably right about the number of users going up, too.
Right, so that it can either be that we only have so many people that are willing to report bugs, which is fair, and or that our quality is getting better and we're actually getting less bugs reported for a larger code base. It's an interesting model, but people are happy with it, and we only go by what our users and our distros. I mean, Linux is still growing at an installed base rapidly. Companies are betting the farm on Linux as far as their embedded devices. All these embedded devices are shipping with it. Garmin, TomTom, little embedded GPS devices, they're all Linux. I mean, so it is working.
Do you think this time-based release model is appropriate for other projects, or is it more necessary for the kernel because of the pace of development?
I think it's a good model in getting something out to people to test. Like you said, people will only test when it's a release comes out. They're not going to be willing to pull a tree from somewhere and build it themselves because they want a distro to package it up for them. So,
right.
I think time-based model, when you're dealing with a whole bunch of people that aren't being paid for it, like I have no way to tell anybody else who works on USB because I'm the USB maintainer, go get this feature done by this certain period of time.
Right.
I can't do that. It's all volunteer-based. So if you say, here's when the time frame is going to be, everybody knows that if they want to get something done, they can get it in by then. Otherwise, they'll work on their own pace.
And by going with a feature release, you're having to push that out because you can't count on volunteer doing anything on a particular schedule.
Exactly. So you're relying on a time of day when it cuts off. As long as you always have a product or something that builds and works. And we have the rule that every single individual patch that gets added to the kernel should not break the build. It should not break the usage model. So you can't add a patch to the kernel. All those 10,000 patches that got added in the last 3 months, that every single individual one of those should not have broken something.
Right. So. And you can bisect back to an individual patch, which did if that happened.
Right. And that's the reason why, because we want to say, hey, if something broke and we can say we know this version worked and this version didn't work, we have tools that will automatically take you through and step through and try different kernels, and you can say this one was good, this one was bad, and it'll narrow you down to the exact patch that broke your problem, caused your problem.
Right.
And it's a really, really powerful tool.
It's not just a person management, but also you have tools which support this development style.
Yes, and yes, we have the tools and we also have the process. So every single patch that gets added to the kernel has been reviewed by at least one person, usually two, and they sign off on it. They say, this is good. So if you break it down and this is the patch that caused the problem, you can look at, hey, these are all the people that said this patch was okay, and then there's the path of blame. You go hit them with an email saying something broke in this patch. and they'll work to fix it.
Right.
So you have local ownership of each individual line of code. So, I mean, that's also another thing unique to Linux. We have this giant code base, and every single line of code can be tracked to all the people that have ever reviewed that line.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty powerful.
Are you also tracking copyright concerns for those lines of code as well?
Implicitly, you can do that. But yes, because it has the ownership of the author.
Right. Interesting.
So, yeah, you can do that if you care about that.
Well, let me get back to the time-based releases. Have you seen Mark Shuttleworth's proposal that distributions should get on the same release schedule?
I have.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, I'm not asking you to speak for Novell, but just as Greg, what do you think?
To be honest, anybody who's ever done this and packaged up, I've worked for three different distros over the years, including Gentoo at one as a developer, as a volunteer. The fact that you need a distro's main job these days is taking these individual pieces that are created by different people and putting them together in a unified way. And it's a very tough problem. And it's tough to get it working right. It's tough to get it working very well. Gentoo and Debian, as they're constantly rolling along, have real problems because they're trying to integrate as things go. The bigger ones like Fedora and OpenSUSE can say, here's the release now. It works much better. They can spend the time and do that. I think Mark is asking other people to do his job for him.
I see.
He has a very small number of developers. He has a very limited development staff. He's starting to diverge more and more away from his Debian base due to the issues between what Debian is shipping at the moment versus what he wants to ship at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look, and by wanting to rely on other people to stabilize that integration is a great thing. You know, if other people can do your work for you, that's a wonderful thing to get them to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to happen.
You think it's not realistic to expect, or you think it's a bad idea in general?
Well, I think it's a combination. So he wants, say, the enterprise kernel. You know, they're going to ship a long-term kernel support based on this specific one. Trying to line up Red Hat and Novell and Ubuntu's just business model and internal business concerns with each other is not fair to ask of a way of companies that compete against each other. I mean, we have a very weird environment with Linux and the fact that there's these different companies that at the management level and the marketing level are competing. They're competitive companies. Red Hat and Novell go after the same customers, the same install base, and they're very, very competitive, yet they have the exact same engineering staff. I mean, Red Hat is Novell's engineering staff, and Novell is Red Hat's engineering staff.
Right.
You can't do stuff to make that upset.
Right.
So it's a very, very weird model, but just trying to align the business model and their time frame of what they wish to do and trying to tell the open source community that you're going to line up with these businesses at the moment in time is a very unfair thing to ask.
Well, how about the projects themselves? I mean, not just Red Hat, but other projects, GCC or Samba, Ruby, Perl. Could those move to a similar type of release schedule and avoid some of those problems?
A time-based release schedule, you mean?
Right. If they said we're going to do two a year or three a year or something like that.
Yeah, you might, but then again, you're going to still be, I mean, over, say we all pick January 1st, we're going to release, and then we're going to try every 3 months after that to do a release for all these projects.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen. Things slip forward, backwards. If you look, I can give you an average time period that the kernel's been released. It's 2.75 months, but we're sometimes faster, sometimes slower.
Right.
We're dealing with individual people. We're dealing with problems. Perl, I mean, would you want to bet on when Perl 6 is going to be out? I mean,
actually, we release a new version every month, but you know, that's a
right.
Question.
That is, okay, sorry. Fair there.
Trapped you there.
All right. But to be fair there, things are going to start slipping and change. And you also, I mean, you got different development models, different communities, different people working at different stages. If, say, somebody gets sick for 2 weeks, you know, what happens?
Right.
What happens when the whole country of France goes on vacation in August, you know? And, you know, your main developer was there at the time. So,
or everybody gets food poisoning at Academy or
exactly.
Garden, like whatever conference.
Exactly. Or everybody just goes to Academy, you know.
Sure.
That could be another thing. So that's a big deal. So, yeah, I don't think, even if we were to say that, I think over time it just wouldn't work out. It would be nice, might be nice the first time around, but after that it's not going to work.
Well, fair enough. A couple more questions here. I think one of my favorite pieces of writing you've done is binary-only kernel drivers are illegal. And, you know, not just because it's nice and controversial. I like that, but because I liked your reasoning on that. But a lot of people don't, and I'm wondering, what do you say when people say you're just trying to prevent my hardware from working?
So I said three things. I said they're illegal, they're unworkable, and they're immoral. Illegal in the fact that every single lawyer I've worked with has said there's no way you can create a Linux kernel driver these days that is not fall under the GPL. IBM has publicly stood up and said so in a conference. A very high vice president said that to a very large group of developers, that they believe that it is not legal to create a non-GPL kernel driver. So it's not just me saying that.
Right.
Novell's public statement is something pretty close to the same thing. I can't remember the exact wording for it. So it's not me just saying that. So that's illegal. So the license of the kernel and the way derivative works is you can't ship a pre-built closed-source Linux kernel driver.
It's not that the source code necessarily of the driver is a derivative work, but the binary version almost certainly is. That was my understanding of Linus's argument here.
Yeah, exactly. You start getting into some parsing of the copyright law in that. So it's in the GPL. It comes under the distribution. You can do whatever you want on your own machines, and we're not ever changing usage model on the distribution. Google, infamous, they have some very large closed source file systems. You know, and they don't have to ship them because it's all internal to the company, and that's fine.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to say there.
So that's illegal. How about immoral?
How about unworkable first?
Well, I think that one's probably the more practical. I want to put that one to the last one.
That is, all right. So immoral. Immoral is the Linux kernel community has released a product that is very, very good. You know, I mean, for some reason, if you want to create a driver for this, you either your customers are asking you for it, or you see some value in using Linux. We've released it under a license that says, we don't care what you do with this, but you have to abide by our license and release the source code back for any changes you make to it. So it is immoral, I say it is immoral for you to take our work and use it in a way that's saying that you feel your tiny contribution is greater than the entire contribution of these thousands of other people who has helped you achieve some goal. You're not playing nice with others, basically.
You're not playing nice with a bunch of others.
A very large bunch of others. And the other fun thing is, it's a very large bunch of others who have very big lawyers. If you look at the copyright holders of the kernel, it's IBM, Intel, Novell, Red Hat, AMD. I mean, these are companies with very big lawyers. Think about whose copyright you're going to violate and what you would want to do there.
Having a bunch of lawyers doesn't mean a lot unless you're willing to use those, though.
Right. Yes, I'm not disagreeing with you there. How do you know they haven't been used?
I don't.
Right. And the reality is almost nothing's been taken to court. There has been things taken to court recently. Most lawyers I've ever talked to are saying if something gets taken to court, they did their job wrong.
Yes.
So that's the very last resort. But look at what's been happening in Germany for the past 2 years. Harald Belt to GPL violation.
Yeah, doing great.
Took Skype. Skype fought it. Skype said, no, we don't believe the GPL is valid here, and they got shot down so hard it wasn't valid.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have court results backing up our agreement.
But there are still proprietary drivers.
There are still proprietary binary drivers. I agree with you. They're out there. They're very well-known companies trying to do that, and they've made their reasons for why they're doing that. And if you look, it is usually them that are taking the risk on that distribution of the kernel, of the driver.
Right.
If you look, it makes sense from a business point of view. I talked to one of them. One of them was saying the fact they wanted to get a company I was working for at the time to ship a closed-source binary driver. And we responded back with the simple fact that if something happened, we got taken to court, and we lost, we would lose the ability to ship Linux. You lose the GPL.
Right.
If they were to lose the right to ship Linux, they don't care because they don't have any Linux they ship or rely on.
That's a good point.
So they've made a business decision to try to flaunt the license. And for some people, they've gotten away with it. Others, they haven't. So there's a lot of companies that have switched over time.
Well, that's interesting, though. I would think that you'd be able to get a copyright injunction to say, cease distributing this infringing piece of software now, and they wouldn't be able to ship their drivers at all.
Yeah, you might, and that has happened.
Interesting.
That has happened in the past. So I have not said that that is not a way. Oh, and there's the new fun rule, and this just got upheld. So the fact that the artistic license case, right?
Right, the Jacobson Katzer case.
Right, so a lot of us were watching that. So there's some fun U.S. law that says if you feel your copyright is being violated and it's being imported, you can tell the customs agents and they will ban it from being imported into a company.
Right.
Into the country. And that's based on the fact that, you know, copyright violations of fashion industry and, you know, purses and things like that, you can stop them being shipped instantly. So
mm-hmm.
now we can use that ruling to stop people from importing products.
That's interesting. I wonder if we could stop shipment of video cards at the border.
Well, no. And to be fair, the company that does that, they don't ship Linux drivers with their product.
That's true. They are very clever about that.
They are very clever, and that's fine. If there's legal ways you can get around it, and I will abide by the law, by the letter of the law of the GPL. I have no problem with that.
Which leads us probably to the impractical question.
The impractical. Oh, the impractical one is, say we were to accept closed source drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Say we were to accept that. That was valid reasoning. So somebody took that thought argument through, and is Arjen van der Ven, who's used to maintain Red Hat's kernel and now works for Intel doing a lot of good kernel stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we took that thought process through and saw what would happen to our community and how things would work out. And it's like the whole process shuts down really, really, really fast. We end up Linux ends up working and acting like the closed source operating system vendors. We do releases at a very long, like 4 to 5 years time frame. Very few people can get support for their devices for it. It just kills our entire development model and shuts the system down. It just wouldn't work from a practical standpoint. It's a really good article.
And you have thousands of developers who don't want to go back to that, but also hundreds of companies who you've converted to use this new development model that don't really want to go back to that, I assume.
Exactly. And but to be fair, a lot of those companies are only doing this because their customers want it.
Right.
I mean, and that's, I have no problem with that. Their customers, I mean, there isn't a network or SCSI card that gets made today that doesn't have Linux support for it, because
mm-hmm.
they know they're Linux, they need support for it. So.
And the trick is, I guess, pushing that towards all devices and laptops.
Right. And if you look, Lenovo is offering some laptops with Linux on it. Dell
mm-hmm.
is offering laptops with Linux on it. And those companies are working with the community and getting that stuff. They're also, those larger companies are pushing back on their hardware vendors. Because, I mean, they buy the chips that go on the motherboards, and they're asking
right.
them to provide the open source driver.
Right.
That's where you can get the strong ones. IBM has been doing that for quite a while. And that's where you get the real change happening.
I look forward to that day.
I think we're there. I mean, I've actually bought a laptop with Linux on it for my past 3 laptops.
Yeah, I have one as well. I bought it from System 76
yeah.
a year or so ago.
Yeah, those guys are good. Emperor
Very
Linux.
Neat.
So yeah, you can do it, and it can work. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's practical. The Asus PC, I mean, that thing is Linux.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great, great model. All those small little tiny PCs are great. HP has a little tiny one they're trying to compete with that ships with Linux on it. I got
mm-hmm.
one of those around here. So big companies are shipping their hardware, and all servers that come out.
Oh, right, yeah.
Automatically working on it. So I think
just
we're getting there.
Laptops, the ones are cracked now, I think. I talked to Arjen about that. He said he had his laptop booting in 5 seconds.
Oh, geez, yeah.
He said he's going to show off that at Plumbers next month.
That'd be good. Yeah, they've been doing a lot. Actually, they've been doing a lot because Intel has that mobile platform.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
they care a lot about that. And some of the embedded guys have done there's some really cool tricks that I don't think that Intel's doing to get the 5 second boot, but there's some really neat ones where you make a suspended disk image,
right.
a suspended RAM image, and you write that to your flash. So how you
right.
start up the machine is you just load that in the flash and go.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of embedded guys do that. I think Sony does that. A lot of their cameras run Linux now.
Well, yeah, 64 megabytes of flash, you can get, I mean, you can do a lot in 64 megabytes.
Yeah, you can do an awful lot. So
the camera doesn't need that much, but...
No. So, yeah. So those are devices that are doing that. I'm thinking those other embedded GPSs, and I have some other Linux-based device. I don't know what it was, but I'm sure it does the same thing. It boots really, really fast.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you know your hardware, you're usually really good. And a lot of the slowdowns is pinned in the BIOS.
Right.
I mean, try and boot a big server and watch how long the BIOS it takes just to finally get around to getting to
yeah.
starting up the kernel.
After the post, you're golden.
Exactly. That was the joke about Itanium. It would take a day, a half hour, or an hour to get just to there.
Yeah, performance doesn't matter because, you know, by the time it's booted up, you've solved the problem on a slower machine.
Exactly, or something like that.